Well, Mr. Chairman and comrades, there's a very popular belief in the modern world that it is the banks and the other financial institutions who completely govern the situation as regards the expansion and contraction of capitalism. That's to say, a lot of trade union people believe this too, and the Labour Party. They argue this, that in a depression, that capitalism is in a depression because the banks and the other financial institutions either are unable or unwilling to lend money to industry to enable them to invest and expand. And that when a boom does take place, that it is simply because the banks at that stage have lent money to industry. When Heath was Prime Minister and Barber was his Chancellor of Exchequer between 1970 and 1974, both of them were always complaining to the banks that they weren't lending enough money to industry, and saying, "No, why don't you lend more money to industry, and then industry would expand and unemployment would fall." And on one occasion, Barber made a speech, I expect some of you remember it, where he said, "We're shouting at them and they're not taking any notice." And when a company or a nationalised industry is in financial difficulties, it's quite natural for them to say, "If only the banks would lend us some money, we'd keep our head above water." I mean, the argument being, of course, that they can't pay their way at the moment, but if somebody would lend them a few million, or in the case of nationalised industries, a few hundred million, they'll carry on until things improve, and then all will be well. Well, the banks deny this entirely. The banks say that, generally speaking, they've always got money that they could lend to companies, and that they can only lend it to companies if companies want to borrow it. And the banks say that, in fact, at the time that Heath and Barber were complaining, the bank's answer to it was that the companies weren't, in fact, going to the banks and trying to borrow money. And they weren't going to the banks to try to borrow money for the simple reason that they didn't want to expand, and they didn't want to invest more, and they didn't want to expand more because they couldn't make a profit out of it. Two or three years ago, the Times ran a campaign likewise attacking the banks and the insurance companies and the pension funds and saying, "Look, why don't you lend more money to industry? Then companies would expand and British exports would increase and there would be fewer unemployed and so on." And they got a very sharp answer from a man who was chairman of one of the financial institutions. He wrote in reply to the Times and said they weren't lending money to companies because companies didn't want to borrow it, and companies didn't want to borrow money because they had no plans for expansion, and that they had no plans for expansion because they couldn't see any field at that time in which they could invest more money profitably. Of course, he didn't mean, when he said nobody wanted to borrow money from him, he didn't mean, of course, there weren't people coming along, as they always are, to the bank with all sorts of crackpot schemes and saying, "You know, nearly a million, I've got some beautiful scheme or other." The banks, of course, are only willing to lend money, which incidentally is not their money, they're only willing to lend money to what they would call credit-worthy schemes, in other words, something where there is a prospect of profit. And the man who entered into this controversy with the Times about it ended up by saying that the editor of the Times should remember that they weren't proposing to lend the Times money to industry. They were asking him to lend the insurance company's money and pension fund money. And he said, "Our job is to look after our clients' money, not to put it into places where we'll never get it back." Now, Marx had something to say about this. Very little attention is ever paid to it, but Marx did in fact hit the nail on the head. It's in Volume 1 of Capital. In the Kerr edition, it's page 695. And what Marx wrote was this: "The superficiality of political economy shows itself in the fact that it looks upon the expansion and contraction of credit, which is a mere symptom of the periodic changes in the industrial cycle, as their cause." In other words, you get the point. Marx would say that the industrial cycle, the movement from depression into small-scale expansion, and then a boom, then a crisis, and a depression, that continuous cycle is governed by what Marx would say the real structural features of capitalism. But these other people, and you see they were saying it then, just as they're saying it now, they look at the thing from the other end and they say, if only the banks would lend more money to the capitalists, we could have a boom whenever we wanted, and in fact, of course, have a permanent boom. Well, you can see a particular example to show how right Marx was and how wrong these other economists were at that time and are still. In this country, the General Electric Company, so on a wine stock company, said last year that they had 800 million of cash. By cash, what they meant was a certain amount of actual cash, some deposits in banks, other money lent to building societies and local governments and to the government itself. But they had 800 million, and that at any time, if they wanted to, GEC could turn that 800 million actually into cash, and they could have gone out and spent it, employing more workers and buying more raw materials to get on with the various sorts of electrical apparatus that GEC are engaged in making. Some of the General Electric money actually, in fact, was deposited in banks, and it's worth remembering this. General Electric, however, didn't want to spend this money. Actually, it goes back several years beyond last year. It's been going up for several years. Obviously, GEC had a certain amount of foresight, and they saw that the market conditions were going to get bad, and they prepared for it by piling up cash at their disposal. But the reason why General Electric don't go out and spend their 800 million and expand production was that there's no profit in it. And there's no profit in it because market conditions were adverse at that time. And actually, the General Electric opposite number in Germany, the bigger of the two electrical combines in Germany, it was reported that they had got not a mere 800 million, but 2,500 million of cash, which they were holding in that same way, and which if they wanted to, they could go out and spend it at any time. Then, now what is it that enables capitalists to invest and expand production when they're in a depression, turn a depression into a boom? Marx spelled it all out in real physical terms. And Marx named three things. He pointed out first that capitalism cannot expand unless there are unemployed, what Marx called an industrial reserve army. If there isn't an industrial reserve army, and some capitalist industry tries to expand, all they can do is to pull workers out of the other industries. Whereas if there is a reserve, they can get the workers they want without interfering with the rest of production. Now, the second of the two requirements for expanding production is that there must be some quantity of raw materials and other things available. General Electric, for example, couldn't suddenly start expanding if at that particular moment there just were not any of the sort of materials on the market that General Electric would want. Well, normally, there is always a certain reserve of raw materials of various kinds enabling industry to expand when the conditions are right. Thirdly, of course, there must be factory space available and machinery available for companies that are expanding their plants to take on the new machinery and increase production. And Marx wrote about this, is on page 693, the technical conditions of the processes of production themselves, machinery, means of transport, etc., now admit of the rapidest transformation of masses of surplus product into additional means of production. You get the view, the things I've mentioned, that you've got to have an industrial reserve, you've got to have unemployed, you've got to have a certain quantity of raw materials and these things available, and that if the missing factor comes into play, that is, the prospect of making a profit, capitalism can quickly expand production and turn these masses of surplus materials into means of production, that is, into machinery, factories, and the rest of it. But if the physical means of production are not there, then production can't be expanded. Now, this goes quite contrary to the belief of the people who think that if only the banks would lend money to industry, industry would expand. You get Marx's point that there's no use promising money to industry to expand if there isn't an industrial reserve army, if there isn't certain quantities of raw materials and factory space and so on for them to do it. If the physical conditions aren't there, the fact that somebody is offering to lend the money won't make any difference to the situation. And there was an example of this in the 1950s, towards the end of the Attlee government. They started a rearmament program. It was part of the Cold War. They wanted to increase British armament, and Parliament agreed to make a very big increase in expenditure on armament. Well, a year later, Attlee reported to Parliament that a very large part of the money that had been voted to expand armament production had not been spent, and the additional armaments had not been produced. And he then explained why this was. It was because with unemployment very low and the shortage of materials, they couldn't have expanded armament production unless they closed down a lot of other production to do it. In other words, coming back to the situation that Marx explained. Incidentally, it was an Iron Bevan, who was Minister of Labour at the time, who got out a booklet for the Ministry of Labour on various incentive schemes for increasing productivity, in which an Iron Bevan was urging the British workers to adopt piecework and things like this so that they could increase production and make additional armament possible. Which of course rather shocked some of Iron Bevan's admirers, who thought that Iron Bevan was a cut above the average young politician. But when the physical conditions do exist for capitalism to expand, then ask yourself why, even if the banks are willing to lend money to industry, you don't get the expansion. And of course, you come back to the question that Marx emphasised all the time: what induces capitalists to invest more or to expand the production in their factories is the prospect of making a profit. And if the prospect of making a profit is not there, it doesn't take place. And the fact that banks may or may not be willing to lend the money is not going to make any difference to the situation. It's also worthwhile remembering that companies are not, or all of them, or even most of them, dependent on the banks. You've got the General Electric case. It wasn't General Electric saying to the banks, lend us money, because General Electric were lending money to the banks. They had quite a lot of money on deposit in the banks. The situation was precisely the reverse. But it was that General Electric didn't want to spend that $800 million because there was no prospect of profit. And incidentally, of course, when there is a prospect of making a profit in an industry, banks can raise money directly from investors. They don't even have to go through the banks. Banks are a convenience, but they are not a necessity. And you'll notice at the present moment that while a lot of industries are depressed in this country, the oil industry isn't depressed. And hundreds or even thousands of millions are being invested in the expansion of the oil industry in this country, and nobody now complains that the banks aren't willing to lend money to the oil companies to do this. Actually, investors are queuing up, so to speak, at the present moment, to lend money to various oil companies to get on with this business. So, just in conclusion, it's a reminder that here is a popular superstition that Marx demolished 100 years ago, and nobody seriously has ever answered Marx on the subject, because so obviously Marx was correct on this particular point.
Any questions on that now?
At the moment,
I now come on to what was the main thing tonight, and that is this question of taxation and the working class. In the second issue of the Socialist Standard in October 1904, there was an article by Fitzgerald called The Bogey of the Taxes. It argued that the amount of taxes and rate and the kind of taxes are the concern of different sections of the capitalist class and don't matter at all to the working class. The taxes the article dealt with were indirect taxes, taxes like VAT, because at that time they were the ways in which the government raised most of its revenue, on taxes on sugar, tea, beer, spirits, coal, various other things like this. And the government at that time raised hardly any money by income tax. And in any event, none of the workers in 1904 came within income tax range. So that article in October 1904 dealt with the indirect taxes, and did not deal with income tax because it simply wasn't necessary at that time. But it did deal, as I say, with indirect taxes, taxes like VAT. It's also worth remembering that income tax at that time was only 5p in the pound compared with the 30p in the pound that it is at the time. The line taken in the article was rejected by the Tories, Liberals, and by the Labour Party. They all said, you know, this is quite wrong. Obviously, they said workers ought to be interested in the kind and amount of taxation because they will be better off if they do so. Whereas the SS article was saying that it doesn't matter to the working class whether taxes are high or low, or whether they are direct or indirect, or whether they're on one kind of commodity or on another kind. Curiously, one line taken by the other organisations at that time, not only the Liberals and Tories, but the Fabians and the Labour Party, took the line that everybody ought to pay taxes, except the real desperately poor who simply couldn't afford to. In other words, they made it a principle. They said every citizen ought to pay taxes, and you'll find this, incidentally, in the Labour Party's election address in May last year. They still adhere to this view that everybody ought to pay taxes. Superficially, the people who say the workers ought to interest themselves in taxes seem to have all the arguments. Today, if you look at it superficially, it seems so obvious that it appears that workers do pay taxes, direct taxes and indirect taxes, and therefore if these were reduced, the workers surely ought to be better off. But if you go into the economics of capitalism, it's quite easy to show that the article in the SS in October 1904 was on the right lines, and the Labour Party and the Fabians and the rest of them are taking a superficial view which does not represent the position of the working class under capitalism. It's also interesting to look at the background of that article. Joseph Chamberlain, the Tory politician, who was a member of the Balfour government, resigned from it in 1903 in order to form the Tariff Reform League. And the Tariff Reform League, under Chamberlain's leadership, then spent two or three years campaigning to get tariffs imposed on manufacturing and other imports into this country. This, by the way, was referred to in the article in the Socialist Standard. Chamberlain and his league argued that the widespread poverty and unemployment and low wages of the workers in 1903 in this country were due to the fact that this country was still free trade, and that if the government imposed tariffs on imports from abroad, that it would get rid of poverty, raise wages, and get rid of unemployment. You will notice, by the way, that while it was Chamberlain the Tory who was saying that in 1903 and 4, the people who are saying this now are sections of the Labour Party and the trade union. It's they who are going to the government last week, the last people, the British Leyland people, various other, the textile industries have been, and steel and all the rest of it, Labour people and trade union people going to the government and saying, look, impose tariffs on these foreign cars and this foreign steel and foreign textiles and so on. In short, they have replaced what Chamberlain was doing in 1903, but using exactly the same sort of arguments. At that time, in 1904, the Labour Party was in harness with the Liberals and was strongly free trade. They opposed Chamberlain's argument at that time that tariffs should be imposed on foreign imports. The Labour Party argument was a different one. The Labour Party argument said that tariffs would raise the cost of living, whereas free trade kept the cost of living low. So the Labour Party at that time was saying to the workers, you don't want tariffs, you want free trade, which means low food prices, because if food prices are low, you will be better off. And in fact, of course, both the Tory argument, Chamberlain argument, and the Labour Party are both of them out of keeping with the actual facts of capitalism. In answer to Chamberlain, who said that tariffs would raise British wages, Fitzgerald, in the argument, replied by pointing out that Germany, which did have tariffs, had wages lower than in this country, and France, which had tariffs, had wages lower than in this country at that time. And also, as far as unemployment was concerned, Germany was just on the verge of the biggest depression it had ever had in its history. And Fitzgerald also pointed out that in another protectionist country, America, where wages were higher than this country, America was also in a depression. So he drew the conclusion that it is quite obvious that unemployment and poverty and so on are not determined by the question whether you do or do not have protection. That you've got to look in another direction to find out what does determine price levels and these other various factors of capitalism. Now, when you come to the case Fitzgerald put, and which is still the valid case, it is really quite a simple one. The working class produce all the wealth of the capitalist world, but the capitalist class own not only the means of production and distribution, but they own also all the commodities that the working class produce each year. But they have to give back to the workers, enough for the workers to live on and maintain their efficiency, and bring up a family to provide the future generation of workers. And when I say must, it isn't, so to speak, a must in the sense of the capitalists have got to pay the workers actually enough to get sufficient food to eat. It's a must that is rather more complicated than that. It's a must depending to a considerable extent and a permanent extent on the willingness of the workers to fight for it. In other words, the capitalist can't say to the workers, look, you could live on a lower standard of living without a lot of the things you have now, because the workers are sufficiently dug in with their trade unions to make it impossible. So you come back to the situation, the capitalists have all this wealth, but they have to give back to the workers enough to maintain the workers in efficiency and go on bringing up a factory. Now, if this is true, it is obvious that all the costs of administering capitalism, the armament costs and all the other administrative costs of capitalist government, must come out of the pockets of the property class. They can't come out of the pockets of the working class, because the amount that the capitalists have to give to the workers, they have to give to the workers. And the capitalists can't say, look, we've had to give to the workers, again, if you like, an average now of, say, £70 or £80 a week, and then say, although we have to give them £70 or £80 a week because we can't force them to accept any less, we are going to make them take less because we've got a heavy taxation bill. They simply can't do it. So it is a perfectly simple case that the burden of administration, capitalism, which is governed by taxation, must be a burden on the people who own the wealth that the workers produce, and not on the working class who produce that wealth. I just offer a word of warning here, it's one I've given before about this, is the point made by Engels, that whenever you're dealing with economic theories, you've got to remember that in the nature of economic theories, you must never push them to too fine a point. What this argument says is that the working class as a body are not the people on whom rests the burden of taxation. But it isn't answered if somebody comes along and points out that certain individuals or certain little groups happen to be better off in the opposite direction, or if they come along and say that in the adjustment to a new taxation or the abolition of the taxation, that there isn't some short period when some of the workers are temporarily better off. I might even take this particular case. If the government go on changing taxation law, as they have done in the last 10 years, having two or three budgets a year and complicating the taxation system, presumably it's very good for the Inland Revenue staff. They get a larger staff and more promotions. But you see, we're not concerned with things like that. That this is an economic law, but you must treat it reasonably and remember that it refers to the working class, not to what may happen to certain exceptional individuals. Also, what can happen from time to time, while the argument may be quite valid, certain other things may be happening at the same time that obscure it. At the present time, in recent years, inflation, of course, obscures this. It just makes it difficult for you to see what's going on, that's all. It doesn't alter the validity of the argument. Now, let's first examine the assumption that wages in general fall when prices fall. You see, this is part of the argument. The argument made in the SS article at that time was that if prices fall, wages come down with them. Now, is this a valid case? Well, actually, there was a very clear-cut case in between the wars, between 1920 and 1926. In those 6 years, the index of retail prices fell exactly 30%. And by a curious coincidence, the wage rate index in the same year also fell exactly 30%. Now, I mean, this may seem that you are carrying it too far. It was just a strange coincidence that the figures happened to come out the same. But the unions made efforts to resist it. There were quite a lot of strikes in 1921, 2 and so on. And general strike in 1926, but it didn't make any difference. Prices had come down and wages had to come down because the employers were in this position. You imagine the effect on employers whose selling prices suddenly fell by 20 or 30%, wiped out the whole of their profit. The capitalists were therefore in the position of having to say to the workers, look, we can't go on paying the rate of wages we have been paying, or we'll be bust. Either you accept a reduction in pay, or we do go bust. And quite a lot of them did go bust, of course. And a lot of the workers put up resistance, but they had to accept the fact of capitalism. That was that prices had come down, and wages came down with them. There is an earlier case, which shows you one of the reasons why you have to be a bit cautious about this. In 1846, the Corn Laws were abolished, and Marx wrote this out in an essay of the abolition of the Corn Laws. The liberal leaders, Cobden and Bryant, led the anti-Corn Law League, and they campaigned up and down the country saying to the workers, look, if you abolish the Corn Laws, food will be cheaper, your wages will buy more, you will be better off. What they really meant was that if prices came down through the abolition of the Corn Laws, then wages would fall with them, and the factory owners would be better off. This is really what the anti-Corn Law League was after. But as Marx pointed out, the Corn Laws were abolished, prices did come down, but in fact wages did not fall as much as prices, because certain other factors were taking place. Unemployment was low, workers were able to put pressure on. So in fact, in that particular instance, the workers, at least for a time, were able to prevent wages falling as much as prices. Now, another example which you've got to consider, does the reduction of rents benefit the working class? You see, this is part of the argument that the main argument is if prices come down, wages come down with them, more or less, in spite of the resistance the workers put up. Now, one subdivision of the case is that the workers are better off because rents are controlled or because rents are kept low. Now, during the war, in many countries in Europe, in most countries in Europe, they introduced rent legislation. In this country, it was introduced in 1915 by a Tory minister, Long. In this country, it merely restricted rents. In some countries, it actually reduced rents. And in Austria, as a result of this legislation, the amount the workers were paying as rent was only 1% of their wages. In other words, rent, for all practical purposes, had disappeared in Austria. Similar situation in Germany and elsewhere. Well, the International Labour Organization conducted inquiries into these countries, and they examined all the facts, and they came out with an absolutely clear-cut conclusion. They said that the workers in all these European countries gained absolutely nothing out of the restriction of rent. But all that it had done was to keep down the workers' cost of living. Wages had gone down with it, and as they said, the people who gained weren't the workers, but the factory owners, because the factory owners were able to pay lower wages. Another case that you've got to take into account is the industries in which the workers receive free board and lodging, or partly free board and lodging, or free travel, and luncheon vouchers, and various things like this. Again, you see, the people who hold the Labour Party argument will say, well, obviously the workers are better off if they receive something free, because it's something they receive on top of their wages. But in fact, as it's quite easy to show, these supposed three things do not increase the worker's total wage. 100 years ago in this country, there were millions of workers who were in this position. Most of the agricultural workers, all the domestic servants, most of the shop assistants and a lot of other workers actually lived in their employer's premises. They got free board and lodging, or partial free board and lodging. But if you then look at what happened to their money wages, you'll find that these were the industries with the lowest money wages in the country. In short, they weren't getting the free board and lodging on top of their money wages, they were getting the free board and lodging in place of their money wages, and their money wages were correspondingly low. Take agriculture, for example. About 100 years ago, say the wage for a man, agricultural worker, averaged about £1.25 a week, which it was something like this. Now, a man who was living in his own cottage and having nothing from the farmer, he would be getting £1.25 a week. If he lived in entirely, as a lot of the young agricultural workers did, had complete free board and lodging, he might be getting, say, 50p a week. If he was in between, if he lived in a farmer's cottage and got some free milk, for free potatoes, or, as in Lincolnshire, 30 stone of bacon a year or something like this, he might be getting 75p a week. But you see, there was only one wage for agricultural workers. It was £1.25, and roughly this is what all of them got. And the belief that they were getting something extra by having it free was an entire illusion. Actually, the post office were the people who reduced this to a fine art. Nowadays, it's common for industries to talk about fair comparison for fixing wages, not only for civil servants and people, but for a lot of other industries as well. Well, the post office were in this business long, long before any of the others. The post office would look at outside wages, as put out by the trade union, and then either a committee of inquiry, sometimes a parliamentary committee, or various other ways, they would fix post office pay in relation to what appeared to be the pay of outside workers. Now, suppose you take, in between the wars, or even before then, suppose you take a postman's pay as £2.50 a week. The post office didn't take £2.50, and then when the unions put it up to them, look, we know some workers getting £3 or £3.10, the post office didn't compare the postman's £2.50 with these outside wages. They carried out a lot of elaborate calculations first. They would say, but a postman has a non-contributory pension, and they worked it out on an actuarial basis, and they said that's worth another 30p a week. So they added 30p onto the £2.50. Then he said the postman has a free uniform, that's worth 5p a week. He has paid holidays, and a lot of outside workers don't have paid holidays, that's worth another 10p a week. And the post office for 100 years had their own medical service, free medical service, and the post office said that's worth another 5p a week. And also, the postman gets quite generous paid sick leave. That's another 5p a week. So they would build up the postman's wage from £2.50 to £3.50 before they began the comparison. And then they showed in something which even they couldn't quantify. They said, anyway, the postman has a job for life. He isn't liable to the sack every few years like a worker in the industry. And this is worth an additional amount, although, as I say, they couldn't quantify it. In short, the postman and the post office staff generally did not get anything free. It was all something that came out of their wages. Nowadays, there are many employers who pay all or part of the travelling expenses of their firms. A lot of firms in London will pay travelling expenses with people travelling in from the suburbs and so on. And then, of course, you've got the railways, the buses and the airlines who make a great play when they're advertising for staff, pointing out to them that you get free and reduced travel on the railways, the buses, and in the case of the airline people, provided there are vacancies on some of their long-distance planes, they can get free trips out to Hong Kong or something like this, which is, and pay nothing for it or practically nothing for it. And this is a great attraction to these people. But here again, this is not something in addition to their pay. Some years ago, I asked a union which organised people at Heathrow, why the levels of pay at Heathrow were so low. And he said, this is it. He said, there are lots of young fellows and girls who are attracted by what they regard as the glamour of working in an airport, and particularly attracted by this possibility of free trips on aeroplanes. And he said, they'll come, so to speak, they've got a queue of people waiting to get jobs there, with the result that it depresses the money wages. I don't know what the present situation is, or whether it is precisely like that. There also, of course, have been schemes for introducing free travel in London, so that all workers in London will be able to travel to and from work free. And the TUC has backed such a scheme. And again, those who support the scheme argue as if it came into operation, wages would remain the same and the workers would get this free travel on top of it, so to speak. But in fact, it would simply operate to reduce wages. And you can see how this would in fact take place. The civil service, a lot of banks and the local authorities have what they call London waiting. And it is calculated, in the case, for example, of the civil service, you have a national rate of pay for the civil service, and the London waiting, which is given to the people in London, because, as they argue, rents are much higher in London than they are in most of the provinces, and secondly, travel is much more costly in London than in the provinces, for two reasons. One, they argue that the fare per mile is more in London than it is in the provinces, and secondly, the people in London have to travel much larger distances to and from work than they do in smaller towns in the provinces. And it's on this basis that London waiting is calculated. Now you see what happens. At the next review, which takes place every year or so, at the next review of London waiting of all these people, the employers will point out to them, and they won't be able to argue about it, that if free travel came into operation in London, London waiting would come down correspondingly. Incidentally, this general argument is discussed by Engels in his pamphlet, The Housing Question, which is worth looking at, where Engels points out that any change which reduces the workers' cost of living generally will inevitably operate to depress wages accordingly. Now, looking at the reverse question, do wages rise when prices rise? Which, of course, again, is part of the essential argument about taxes not being a burden on the working class. Since 1938, prices in this country are on average about 14 times what they were in 1938 at the present time. But wage rates and earnings have risen considerably more than 14 times what they were in 1938. It isn't quite as good as it looked, because what you've really got to look at is take-home pay, and the way PAYE is organised, take-home pay does not increase as much as gross pay. But even then, when you've made allowance for this, take-home pay has increased on average for the workers in this country by more than the 14 times that the price level has increased. In the 1950s, the American Department of Labour, their people in London, set up an inquiry into what had happened to British workers' wages, and they collected all the information, and they came out with this conclusion, which was wanted by the American government for looking at this problem at home in America. They came out with this conclusion that although the amount of income tax that appeared to be paid by the workers was much higher in 1950 than it was in 1938, not higher, only higher in amount, but in proportion to wages, that in fact average wages in this country had increased by more than by an amount more than was sufficient to compensate for the fact that PAYE had also increased more than the average. Incidentally, one other thing can be looked at. If this argument is true, it does not matter to the working class what causes prices to rise or what causes them to fall, because in the struggle, wages will, unless some other change takes place, wages will adjust themselves to it. So it doesn't matter what causes prices to rise, but just taking a side look, so to speak, it's worth noticing that the argument that taxes raise prices is itself an invalid argument. Although most of the people who go into this question take for granted that if a tax is put on some article, that it will automatically put up the price of the article. Now Marx dealt with this, and it's still a valid argument. Marx pointed out that the capitalist always sells his commodity at the highest price the market will bear. But if he's selling his commodity at the highest price the market will bear, the fact that he has to pay a tax does not enable him to sell his commodity at a price higher than the market will bear. In other words, the tax comes out of his pocket because he cannot simply pass it on because he wants to. The Labour Party, of course, doesn't take this view. The Labour Party always acts on the assumption that if a tax is put on something, that the seller, the capitalist, will be able to put up his prices accordingly. Last week, the Confederation of British Industries published the results of an inquiry they made among 2,000 of their member firms. What they asked them was this: do you expect in the coming year to be able to put up your prices to meet the additional costs of production? Only 37% of them said they expected to be able to put up their prices in the coming year. Most of them said they did not expect to be able to put up their prices in spite of the increased cost of production. And 7% of them said they regretted they were in a position where they'd have to reduce their prices. And some of you may notice an article in the Sunday Times today about the war that's going on among the stores, what they call the high street stores, where in fierce competition, they are in fact reducing their prices, obviously in many cases, below cost of production for the time being. Incidentally, another argument Marx used: if capitalists could pass on their taxes, why would they waste their time lobbying in the government trying to pass the burden on to somebody else, as in fact the capitalists do? You will also see this operating in reverse. Notice what happens when a tax is removed. In the article in the Socialist Standard in October 1904, one of the cases used was the petrol tax in Australia. Standard Oil had a practical monopoly of importing oil into Australia at that time, and there was a tax of threepence a gallon on it. Standard Oil sold to the retailers at sixpence a gallon, and the retailers sold at a retail price of 11p a gallon. Well, a big campaign was led against the tax, on the argument being used: get rid of the tax, the workers will be better off. Well, the day that the threepence a gallon was removed, Standard Oil, they increased their charge to the retailers up to ninepence, and the retail price remained exactly as it was before, at 11p a gallon. So the only people who gained were Standard Oil in that particular case. And in this country in 1960, there was still an entertainment tax payable by theatres and cinemas. And a great campaign was led, was waged about it, and the argument they used was that if the tax was removed, they'd lower their prices, they'd get more people coming to cinemas, and everybody would be happy. Well, the tax was removed in April 1960, and the Ministry of Labour figures about the effect on prices showed that not only did theatre and cinema charges fall, but the cinema charges in particular went up after the tax was removed. They didn't go down. I mean, this again confirms the general argument. Now, all of that article dealt with, as I say, indirect taxes, non-income tax, because the workers didn't pay income tax. But if you come to income tax, which was not dealt with, you will see that the argument is just as valid in the case of income tax. All through the 19th century, the workers in this country paid no income tax. There was an income tax, though it was very low, but workers' wages were so low they didn't even come into the range. But at the time of the Crimean War, an attempt was made to bring workers into the range of income tax. Various interested political parties argued it, and the government looked into it, and it was rejected for two reasons. First, the Inland Revenue people objected to it. They said, look, if we have to collect thousands of small sums from thousands of workers, it'll cost us more to collect the tax than we should get out of the tax. It's certainly not worthwhile. But the employers also opposed bringing workers into the range of income tax. at that time, unemployment was very low, and what the employer said to the government was this: look, if you bring workers into income tax and make them make some deduction from their pay for taxation, all that will happen is the workers will immediately press for higher wages, and we shall have to pay. They might just as well leave things as they are, and in fact, that is what they decided to do. I've also already mentioned the fact that PAYE is ever so much greater as a proportion of wages than it was in 1938. So on the face of it, the people who believe that the workers, that taxes are a burden on the workers, will say that then the workers must have lost by this increase of PAYE. But in fact, they haven't. As I've already pointed out, when you look at take-home pay, it has increased on average for workers in this country by considerably more than the way the cost of living, the price index, has multiplied by 14. Again, of course, you remember there is always a key factor in all of these things, and that is that the workers behave moderately sensibly and use their trade union organisation to take every opportunity they can at any time to get wages as high as they can in the circumstances. The last question, and that was dealt with in the article in 1904, was the question of rates. Again, rates are a burden on the landlord and not on tenants. It seems to be different in the case of people who take out mortgages and are therefore not tenants, but are ultimately buyers of houses. But this is only an appearance. If you take into account all of the factors, the amount the worker has to pay on his mortgage, his interest charges, repayment of capital, and set against it the fact that at some distant time in the future he will get the actual house that he's been buying all the time, and if you compare this with his position if he'd remained a tenant all the time, you'll find that there's simply nothing in it. Both of them have in fact been buying accommodation just like they buy any other commodity. And in any event, except when conditions are adverse, wages generally will rise in line with whatever the cost is of the workers' houses. The point that Engels dealt with in his pamphlet, The Housing Question. As regards changes of rates, the SS article quoted what happened when the Central London Railway was opened. As a consequence of opening the Central London Railway, rents in Shepherd's Bush rose by 3 shillings in the pound, because one of the consequences of opening the railway was there was a big demand, additional demand for houses in the Shepherd's Bush area. After rents had gone up 3 shillings in the pound, rates then went up in the area. But the article pointed out that rates did not go up again, the rents did not go up again after the rates had gone up. Rents stayed at the level they had reached already. In short, the additional rates were a burden on the landlord. And an example in the opposite direction, in West Ham, which was the highest rated district in the whole country, rents were falling owing to falling demand for houses at the same time that rates were rising, again showing that the burden fell on the landlords, not the workers. One book, I expect it's out of print now, was a book called History of Local Rates in England by Professor Cannon, where Cannon dealt with the struggle over rates, not so much the detailed business of tenants and so on, but the bigger question of rates, where he pointed out that the struggle that went on in the 19th century was between the agrarian interest trying to duck away from rates and get the local expenses paid by the central government. In short, they were trying to pass the burden on to the manufacturers and duck out of it from themselves. And without knowing what the details now about rating, it's quite obvious that the agrarian, the agricultural interests in this country still are in a very favourable position as compared with manufacturers in respect of rating. Just a last reference to the Labour Party and Fabian Society principle. Their principle was, Fabian was laying it down in the 1880s, and the Labour Party continued it until comparatively recently anyway. I don't know whether they still hold it. They argued that everybody should pay tax, and that the government should raise all taxes directly, that is by income tax and death duties, and not indirectly by taxes on stuff sold in the shop, except with regard to luxury goods. And when they used this argument, what they really meant was the workers don't get luxury goods, this also will fall on the rich. But in fact, if you look at what has happened to them, that was the principle they laid down, but in the course of years in running capitalism, they've had to fall into line more or less with what the Tories have done. And you'll find that in the last Labour government from 1974 to 79, nearly half of their revenue was in fact raised by indirect taxes and not by the direct taxes, which they said ought to be the method of raising taxes. Lastly, at the last election, the Labour Party put forward a proposal that if they were, when they become the government again, they will have a provision for an annual wealth tax on all fortunes of £150,000 or more. But again, it's only necessary to point out this is of no concern to the working class. They won't even appear to be paying this. It will simply alter the distribution of taxation, the burden of taxation, among the different sections of the capitalist class themselves. Only one last word in conclusion. All of this, as I said before, depends on the workers behaving reasonably, making what use they can of trade union organisation, and not let themselves be deceived from time to time into accepting and approving income policy to keep down wages.